Recognition that this year is the 30th anniversary of the Civil Liberties Act of 1988, that was the official apology to everyone of Japanese ancestry that was incarcerated. And there was reparations, but it was really the apology that everyone wanted. But you had to be living. And so people like my grandparents who had passed away, you know, there was nothing, you know, that they would have received. And it didn't go to the family, you know, per se, only those two that were living. But the important reason that the reparations was needed was for education. So that's when the Civil Liberties Public Education Fund, originally sanctioned by Congress, was started so that we could educate, you know, future generations about, you know, really the inhumanity of the incarceration. And what's happening today.
Karen Korematsu, I want to thank you for being with us, daughter of Fred Korematsu, head of the Fred T. Korematsu Institute. That does it for our show. A correction, it was Yip Harburg and Harold Arlen who wrote the song Paper Moon. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now! Thanks for joining us.
The following edition of the new WHFR Journal has been pre-recorded and edited for time and for content. Enjoy.
Good afternoon and welcome to the new WHFR Journal. I'm Alan Mazurek. Susan McGraw is with us for the program today as well as we look at views and opinions of things going on in Dearborn and in our community, things that we hope you find important and interesting. We hope you'll stay with us for the next hour. Boy, big news this week, of course, is that now that finally we've got what I think we can officially consider to be spring, it's just in time for final exam week here at Henry Ford College, which starts next week, in which case things start to get into a sort of a different rhythm here at the campus. But that doesn't mean that there aren't still interesting things going on, and we want to talk a little bit about some of that. And this is a series of performances that are going on with our theater department here at Henry Ford College. It is a season-ending presentation of six different short one-act plays, which will be performed next Thursday at 8 p.m. through Saturday at 8 p.m. and then a 2 o'clock matinee the following Sunday. So just to be straight, this is going to start Thursday, May 3rd, and we'll have performances Thursday, Friday, Saturday at 8 p.m. and then on Sunday, May 6th at 2 p.m. The performances take place in the McKenzie Fine Arts Center here in Building F, Room 161. Information about the plays and to purchase tickets can be found at theater.hfcc.edu. There are a total of six different short one-act plays, including Scar Tissue by Gabriel Rivas Gomez, DMV Tyrant by Christopher Durang, Mountain Language by Harold Pinter, The Contract by Teresa Rebick, The Rainbow by James Armstrong, and The Janitor by August Wilson. So one chance as we head out into summer vacation for a lot of the students, although quite a few of them are still around during spring and summer terms, but one more chance to enjoy their fine efforts and all of the hard work that they put into putting together great performances for the audiences here at Henry Ford College. Once again, theater.hfcc.edu is where you can find tickets. Or for more information, you can call 313-845-9817. Seats are $5 for these performances, so six short one-act plays taking place next Thursday through Sunday here on the HFC campus in Building F. All right, that gets us started. There's lots to come on the program today. We're going to jump into it in just a moment. You're listening to the new WHFR Journal here on WHFR 89.3 FM and also online at WHFR.fm, making waves.
Thank you for being with us. This is the new WHFR Journal. I'm Susan McGraw, along with Alan Mazurek. And Alan, you know, every month it seems here in the United States, we celebrate something different, or we commemorate something, or sort of pay tribute to, or shine the spotlight on a different component of something out there in the world. In April, not just in the United States, but internationally, and I just learned that, the topic of autism comes to the forefront. And autism affects affects so many more people than we can even imagine in this day and age. I think it's certainly deserving as a topic of being something to learn about and to be informed about internationally, of all things. So we're excited to be able to sort of shine our spotlight a little bit on the topic of autism and get into some of the nuts and bolts of how this whole thing works, and in fact what we can do to try to have some awareness, have some tolerance, and even some education on this field. Do you have any background in this subject matter at all?
No, as far as I can remember, no relevant personal experience mm-hmm. in terms of people I know. Although, I mean, obviously, I know of several close friends that have, you know, children that have been dealing with this issue. But yeah, just and when you say shine a spotlight. And that's an important thing, because it's easy to become jaded when it seems like that spotlight jumps around from month to month.
Sure.
But on the other hand, these are important issues and things that, you know, need to be addressed and deserve their moment, you know, in the spotlight in terms of our awareness of what's going on in the world around us.
Yeah. All too often we hear the bad side of people dealing with autism or living with autism based on an issue that happened with someone not understanding how how the process works, or dealing with a law enforcement person who wrongly interpreted someone's autism symptoms as being inappropriate or acting belligerently or being on drugs or something. Mm-hmm. And all too often those do not end well. Mm-hmm. So I think the idea of learning about this disorder will be very, very helpful, I think, to everybody. Here in the Dearborn community alone, there are thousands of people that are diagnosed with some form of autism. There's three main kinds, and we'll let the experts tell us all the specifics mm-hmm. about that. But this is not new to any community. It's not new to any family members, and most people know at least somebody related to somebody that is suffering from autism or living with autism.
Sure.
I shouldn't say suffering from. Well, you know, all that being said,
seems like we're in a good place with our guest today.
Yeah.
Here on the new WHFR Journal, we want to welcome in Dennis A. Brown II, who's joining us for the program today, and somebody who is actually not unfamiliar with our campus and with our radio station. It's nice to have you back here, Dennis. And I'm thrilled with this, you know, as a parent myself, but not somebody who deals with, you know, autism on a daily basis. The title of a series of articles that you wrote, Patience is a Virtue. That seems like everything that every parent needs to deal with, but you take this in a different direction in terms of how it deals with with people who deal with autism on
yes,
a daily basis.
That's
yeah.
correct.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dennis's voice, when we start chatting with him here, might be recognizable. He does a series of autism awareness PSAs, public mm-hmm. service announcements, that we run on our station as well as other non-commercial stations, I should say, in the Metro Detroit area. And Dennis, as a former staff member of WHFR, he's kind of like an icon here, and I'm not kidding, really. Dennis coordinated and was the reason behind something that we did for 10 years, which was the WHFR charity bowling event.
Mm-hmm.
Some of our longtime listeners might remember this. It was Dennis's idea originally, and every year we'd pick a different charity, and we would get together as a group and bring in listeners, and we would bowl for that charity. And we made really good money for some great organizations, but that was Dennis. And in addition to all of those public service-related things and news-related things, well, Dennis, you always put on a really good music show, so we miss that, but we're so glad to have you back on our air waves here at WHFR.
I'm glad to be back.
Thank you. Tell us, what was your time here at WHFR? I know you're with us for several years.
Yes, I was there from January of 93 until December of 2000.
Okay. And you have a personal story, and your story has evolved over the years. I know that some people that are not diagnosed or misdiagnosed with something other than what they're really living with, in this case, autism, can be diagnosed as ADD, ADHD, different other types of social or anxiety disorders, or even inability to learn effectively some form of a learning disability when, in fact, those aren't always the case as far as autism is concerned. Mm-hmm. So tell us your story, if you will.
It happened in 1989, early my senior year of high school. I was diagnosed as being in the autism spectrum disorder. And this happened because my parents couldn't figure out my behavior problems. And then I tried living a normal life from the time I graduated from high school, which was in 1990, until the day after Super Bowl Sunday of 2007. Mm-hmm. That was when I had an extreme bout with depression.
Okay. And let's back up just a minute before we get into that really life-altering experience that mm-hmm. you went through, which really has changed things, I think, for the good, because it prompted a different diagnosis. But you said your parents had some problems and some behavior problems.
And acting out in school.
Okay, yeah, because Dennis is the most gentlemanly, wonderful guy. I've known you for years, but that wasn't always the case. So what was going on?
Well, I would imitate people, some people during class time, you know, characters and famous people.
Okay.
And
acting out
in
school. So behavior that perhaps just wasn't necessarily appropriate for the situation.
Yeah.
And people got ticked off, and people maybe made fun of you, or mm-hmm. people kicked you out of the room, or you just got in trouble a lot.
Yeah.
Okay. It was not something necessarily that you could control, but you were aware of it?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Okay. And so you were diagnosed, as you said, with being on the spectrum, the autism spectrum disorder.
Yes.
What exactly is that?
Well, it consists of, it's a wide range of things. It could be a complete autism, like the movie Rain Man, mm-hmm. for example. Then you have my case, which is severe Asperger's syndrome. It's mild and high functioning form.
Okay, Asperger's syndrome. We've heard that a lot in recent years as well.
Yes.
As being something that once diagnosed, someone can really live perfectly normal life, just you know, doing their thing, and again, it's about that awareness and patience, as Alan mentioned. So thank you for that. Now, what kind of support did you receive once that diagnosis happened?
My parents helped me out. I got help with Team Mental Health Services in Southgate and Services to Enhance Potential.
Okay, what kind of things did they do? What type of
support was
there? I
went through therapy. They got case management.
Okay, good. Talking out some things as well as maybe learning the sort of social cues, maybe what's more appropriate, what's less appropriate, that kind mm-hmm. of stuff. Okay.
Yep.
And then, so now, thank you for that. So now leading up to the day after Super Bowl Sunday, as you mentioned.
Well, I was out of work. I was in a massive amount of debt. And my brother overheard the phone conversation that I had. And that was when I mentioned the unthinkable. Mm-hmm. And I was taken to a hospital, one in the Trenton area, I think, the downriver, and then I was transferred to a hospital in Madison Heights, and then that was when I found out I had Asperger's syndrome.
Okay. So, in other words, your brother heard you potentially threatening to take your own life,
mm-hmm.
and that was his wake-up call to say, wait, this isn't Dennis. This isn't the way things normally go with this fun-loving, mm-hmm. happy-go-lucky, you mm-hmm. know, sweet guy.
I was afraid to tell my parents and my brother because I was afraid of getting yelled at. That was the thing.
Okay. Why were you afraid of that?
I just was afraid. I just wanted to keep it private.
Okay. So you live with that, and you mm-hmm. kept it in until it finally boiled over.
Yep.
So it wasn't an instantaneous thing. It was just a buildup.
Yep.
Okay. Boy, we... a lot of us have these issues where we're dealing with things like debt or, mm-hmm. you know, failure with the school situation or being fired or something. But so combining the autism spectrum disorder and the mounting challenges, you, instead of asking for help or sharing help, you were sort of imploding.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, a family member discovered that and said, wait, something's going on. Mm-hmm. So once you were hospitalized, how was the diagnosis of Asperger's syndrome?
It came just when I was leaving, on the day of my release. I was with mom and dad and Dr. Haddad.
Okay.
At the hospital in Madison Heights.
How did they come up with this?
Well, my dad actually did an online investigation on my condition, and he presented the findings to the doctor.
Okay, and the doctor said, yeah, that sounds about right. And mm-hmm. so they
And the diagnosis was confirmed actually a year later from a psychiatrist who was my family therapist that I had in my senior year of high school.
Interesting. Do you think that it's something that we didn't know much about Asperger's syndrome at that time, or because it wasn't talked about a lot? You know, nowadays we have all these celebrities and things that come out and talk about
it. It was not a big attention grabber way back then.
Okay. So even though it existed, it wasn't necessarily on people's radar to say that's what he's got going on. Okay. Symptoms of Asperger's syndrome, if you would.
Well, my case is I'm afraid of telling the truth, like I said, because I was afraid of getting yelled at. Laughing and crying for no reason, for the wrong reason. That this is just not just Asperger's, but the entire autism spectrum disorder. Afraid of changing. I mean, you like everything to be the same.
You like routines.
Yeah, routine. Mm-hmm. And one change in routine can cause someone to blow up, basically. Mm-hmm. And but there are other symptoms of autism that can happen. There's no smiles and babbling or social skills, and that can happen as early as infancy.
Yeah, I was doing a little research on this in terms of how soon is too soon to start considering a potential diagnosis of autism. And they say it's by 1 year, 1 year old, 1 year of age for a child, if they're not responding to their name, if they're not doing the big laughs and the smiles and the coos and that kind of stuff, then maybe it is something to look at. There are a lot of public service announcements that are running now on other stations as well as ours during this month, because we are, again, spotlighting autism because it is, the numbers are just becoming startling. Not necessarily numbers that have changed, but just numbers based on awareness now and diagnosis, which is important.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing the issue, the illness is half the battle, so we can know how to deal with it, so how to treat it. Backing up just a little bit, Alan, and again, you're still sort of our newbie here at WHFR, even though you're not, Dennis has won mega awards in newscasts. He has a successful voiceover business. He keeps a good job. He is, fully intelligent. And in addition, this guy can pretty much tell you anything you want to know about pro bowlers, game shows. What else? What other specialties, Dennis? Those are the two big ones, as I recall.
Yeah, those are the two big ones, yeah.
But I mean, some amazing. Sports
some stuff. Sports, yeah.
Yeah. Do you find that maybe those skills also have something to do potentially with the Asperger's? Because I don't know many people that I can say
You've heard of something the phrase...
How do we separate, stereotype from just sort of,
Well, you've heard of the phrase one-track mind?
Yeah.
I mean... That's basically all I talk about is game shows and sports.
I'm a big Jeopardy fan.
Yeah. Yeah. But
we should watch Jeopardy sometime.
Yeah. But bowling, and it's just that I have this thing of remembering what happened on a game show 30 years ago when I was a kid.
Yeah, he can tell you who won the $20,000 pyramid and what the question was and what day and year and who won the. It's incredible. I mean, it's highly impressive. Mm-hmm. But you said one track mind because that's what your brain focuses on.
Yeah,
which is a part of what autism actually is and does.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Interesting.
Well, and a lot of people, when you say that, I think a lot of people have formative memories, things that they carry with them through life. Where do we make the distinction between sort of, stuff we remember and start to say, okay, maybe there's another issue with how this person's brain works and we need to start to evaluate it and learn a little bit more about how this person's brain operates and how they can function in the world?
Yeah, I think it's more if it happens continuously, which was my case.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. When it comes to social cues, I've done research and I've seen that tends to be one of the other big sort of red flags in terms of just a comfort level. Again, like kind of dialing into one situation or one person, maybe like you said, the being comfortable with change, you get six people walk in, you don't know who they are, can be a little freaky, a little intimidating and that kind of thing. But like we've talked, that's why it's called the spectrum, because it is a spectrum. It's not any one, two, or three kinds of things. And people can fall anywhere in that, within that category, yes?
Yeah.
Okay. We've heard of mild forms of autism and severe cases of autism. At what point is it a situation where medication will help, or...
There is no medication. There's no cure for autism. There is actually no medication that can fix the problem.
Right, right. Dealing, though, with things like anxiety and
relaxation
and that kind of thing.
I was taking first Abilify for my depression and anxiety. Then I was taken off the drug because it made me drowsy, and I was put on Celexa.
Okay.
And I was doing better, and I was taking off the drug. I wanted to be off the drug altogether.
Sure. And you raise a good point. We know that there's not a cure for this. We know that medication doesn't fix it or anything. So really what we're doing is kind of like when you take an aspirin for a headache. It's not fixing the headache. It's just it's helping the symptoms, which is the situation. And again, any medications, any diagnoses that we're talking about here are very specific to Dennis's case. And we're not trying to give any medical advice or, anything
like
that. These are views that are based on this guest in this situation. Just understand that.
Let me ask you this, Dennis. From your experience, having grown up and reached a point where you were fully an adult when you realized this was the situation, from what you know about it, how different is it, or is it different for kids these days that might be in a similar situation? Is there more awareness from teachers?
Well,
from
a lot more
professionals.
A lot more parents are becoming aware of it nowadays, because what happened was, I saw this on the web, and it's going to be in an upcoming editorial, that supposedly 1 in 36 kids are now diagnosed or living with autism, because there's like a new way of finding out.
I was going to say, is that a combination? Is that environmental factors, things that are going on, or is it just more awareness?
Well, I don't know if it's a combination of, environmental.
Mm-hmm.
Because the causes have been investigated for who knows how long, and nothing has been uncovered, nothing concrete. Mm-hmm. And the problem, and what makes things even worse, is that it's been put on the shelf way too long.
It's about time that we have had some people that have had the spotlight on them. Again, famous athletes, famous celebrities that come out, and in years back, they would actually kind of hide the fact that they had a child with some form of autism.
Or another celebrity who was diagnosed with a form of autism themselves.
Good point. Yeah, it's out there. So when we talk about what we can do, the diagnosis part, and we'll leave the medical part to the experts, of course, but certainly the Autism Speaks organization is one that we look forward to talking more about and learning more about, and I know you've worked with them. You also mentioned the other organization that you got some support with, and that's Team Mental Health.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Their organization, it's now called Team Wellness.
Okay.
The one I went to was in Southgate. I was there just after I got released from the hospital. I was there for like 6 years, and I was going through therapy and case management.
Mm-hmm. Good. Dennis actually also did some game show hosting for some special events there. I went to a couple of those. They were really fun, really exciting. Back to that. That's the focus. That's his thing, and it's very exciting. Dennis, when we talk about things in the media, and we hear about stories of someone that did something crazy, and the police, for whatever reason, felt threatened, or somebody else felt threatened, and they called the police, or this and that, and it ends up that it really was just someone that had a disability, that had some form of autism. That's sort of heart-wrenching. I mean, it really is, because it's not a matter of being able to control, certainly, different circumstances, especially in a tense environment. That's when symptoms flare up, isn't
yes, it? Yes, that can happen.
Okay.
Absolutely.
You recently, as we talked about, wrote this Patience is a Virtue, and then Law Enforcement is the sort of the subhead.
That's actually the fourth one I wrote, fourth part of the series I wrote from last year. It was a three-parter called Patience is a Virtue. The first part was in the home and parenting.
Mm-hmm.
Second part was in the schools, and then the third part was on the job.
Mm. So now you've got law enforcement to continue that.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about this article, and where can we find it?
Well, it will be on the DownriverSundayTimes.com, or it is on there right now, as a matter of fact. You can look in the editorial section.
Mm-hmm. And what's the deal with law enforcement? What's your take on this?
Well, I mean, you look at it two ways. The one part is law enforcement needs to be trained on dealing with people who have autism. But on the other side of the coin, you can't just send someone out to, quote-unquote, fend for themselves.
Mm-hmm. So many of the stories I've heard in the media have been a young person, or even a middle-aged guy, and autism does affect males substantially more than females, for whatever reason, statistically. Mm-hmm. But you have a guy that goes out maybe to get something at the corner market or something, and even though he's has autism and perhaps shouldn't be in that environment on his own. Somebody triggers something, somebody gets too close to him, or he feels threatened, or he is being jovial and taps somebody on the shoulder just to be nice and say hi, and somebody misinterprets something. And we live in a difficult world,
obviously. And it happened with the police deputy in Ohio, as I wrote in the editorial.
Oh, yes. I remember
reading
that story.
Tell us about that. Yeah.
Well, it happened. The guy was picked up. And he had autism and Tourette's syndrome. And he was at near a public school. I can't remember the city, but he was playfully touching people. Then there was a deputy who wanted none of it, so he slapped the guy's hand away and body slammed him. And he died from massive head injuries. And to make matters worse, the deputy was cleared of any wrongdoing after an investigation.
Yeah, that was about 3 years ago that situation took place. And I know there's a lot of them out there. Mental illness and different forms of lack of diagnosis certainly is a terrible tragedy these days.
It can lead to it, yes.
We talked about mental illness and gun violence, and that's something we're going to talk more about actually on Monday. There's a public forum at Fordson High School to discuss gun violence as it relates to keeping our students safe in the schools. But oftentimes, you've heard that thing somebody says, they can't be in their right mind. They shot 10 innocent people or something. Well, again, it's the access to the weapons, different topic, but it also potentially is being in a situation where you don't feel like help is available.
Yeah, and this recent event that happened in Parkland, Florida, where the guy shot up a school there, and the deputy who just stood outside and did nothing, well, the guy that did the shooting supposedly, and I say supposedly, had autism or was in the spectrum.
Interesting.
And I kind of find out it's shocking.
Yeah. We are not excusing any horrific behavior. Mm-hmm. It is never, ever excusable, of course, but being aware so that treatment can get better and can improve and people can be diagnosed and benefit from some of the knowledge that's coming out today is important. Literally here at our campus this week, earlier in the week, we brought in an expert who actually has two children that have autism that did some sensitivity training on our campus as teachers and as security forces on at any college campus or any school campus. We need to know certain things so we can not only interpret behavior, but then also know how to respond to it and how to navigate it in the right direction. So this is important. People are taking it very seriously, finally. Coincidence that it happened in the month of April, I guess, but it's the second time, actually, that this particular trainer came in to talk about it. So I'm certainly glad to see that our campus community is aware and trying to inspire others to make better judgments and choices as it comes to this. When we talk about the opportunity to learn more, Dennis, what would you suggest people do if they want to find out, not necessarily about diagnosing a family member or a friend, but just learning more about this so that they can feel more prepared should somebody down the street be having some unusual behavior?
Well, I mean, what we need is a lot more advocacy, especially for the adults who are diagnosed as being in the autism spectrum disorder.
Okay. What do you mean by that? What would you like to see?
Well, I was once called an advocate because of the editorials and the PSAs that I've been recording, and that's not true. I am not an advocate. I might be an inspiration, but a real advocate acts as the voice of someone who does not use it or cannot use it.
How, since you were fully an adult when you found this out about yourself, I guess, how has your life changed knowing that about yourself?
Well, I mean, there's some things I cannot do anymore, but there's some other things I can do.
Okay, so you sort of know limitations, perhaps, or you know things that maybe you might not want to risk potentially being in a situation with. But also, Dennis, I've seen you do some amazing things. So when we talk about boundaries and risks and limits and stuff, boy, I understand and I get it. I mean, gamblers shouldn't hang out at casinos if they're gamblers. You know what I mean? That's a bad example, but you know what I'm saying. So, so while I've seen potential for different, sort of steering behaviors in different ways, you have an amazing life. You have a wonderful family. Mm-hmm. Love your car. You got a lot of great stuff going on. So you really are. You might not call yourself an advocate, but I think you're living proof that people can have enriching, successful, fulfilling lives through a diagnosis like yours. How do you feel about that?
Well, I mean, I'm trying to live a normal life right now with working and doing all that.
Yeah. There you go. He's humble, too. That's for sure. So we appreciate your time, Dennis. We think this is a such a worthwhile topic, and we look forward to continuing to read more of your work on the subject. And again, we look forward to sometime soon getting in somebody to talk a little more about the medical side of this.
But, and again, I was going to say, where can we see some of those columns?
There's Dearborn Times Herald at downriversundaytimes.com. You can also punch up the Dearborn Press and Guides website. A few landed there, and two of them actually landed in the Detroit News.
Very good.
Very nice.
And that was kind of surprising. But what surprised me even more was that the one I wrote in 2016 called Autism Awareness Month, The Worst Is Yet to Come, it landed in 5 newspapers.
Very nice.
And what was that column about?
Okay, well, you're going to have more adults being diagnosed with autism by the year 2030. In fact, it's supposed to climb by a whopping 700%. And also, the number of people who have autism are going to be aged out in school-based support programs when they reach 21 by the year 2025. And you're also going to have the cost of care taking a climb. In fact, I think by the year 2025 also, the cost of care is supposed to range anywhere from about $460 to about $1 billion, $461 to $1 billion.
So the more we learn about it and the more people are diagnosed, the more money we need, but the more it sort of gets soaked up like a sponge, and so there's going to be this perfect storm coming out.
Yeah.
And unless we do something now, as a community and as a group of citizens, how are we going to navigate through this?
Part of that's a learning curve. Part of it is a treatment curve. I mean, if we call it a spectrum, I guess probably all of us are somewhere on what we would call the spectrum, whether we're, if you look at a spectrum as like 0 to 100, whether we're closer to 1 or 2 or 98 or 99, we're all somewhere there, and kind of where do we start to begin and put our resources towards treatment and care for people that are at a place where they really need it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think going back to the idea of patience, tolerance, acceptance, and understanding, and inclusion, especially for younger people, it's hard enough to be a kid in school, with the other kids that are kind of not so nice. But imagine being a kid in school and, having certain behaviors that maybe you can't really control, or even if you have been diagnosed, knowing that this is what your life consists of. So as parents of other kids, teaching that respect, teaching that inclusion and that tolerance. And in addition, the idea of not just jumping to assume that everybody's bad, that just because somebody's acting differently, it doesn't necessarily mean they're on drugs and they're going to do terrible things. There could just be something else to it. And in many cases, that something else is autism.
Yep.
So, yeah.
And I've got a couple, and that's the first of four columns that I wrote that are going to be hitting the Dearborn Times Herald. I got a two-parter coming up called Don't Turn Your Back. You should not turn your back on the kids who have autism and on the adults who are in the autism spectrum disorder. And there was a back 3 years ago, there was a nationally televised show, Dateline NBC, that did a story about two young adults from New York State who were diagnosed with autism, and they were struggling to find, get help. And the last one I wrote is called Going From Bad to Worse. You got as many as 90% of the young adults ages 18 to 21 who are in the autism spectrum disorder are either unemployed or underemployed. And also, the amount of spending that's going on, you got spending on ailments that are less prevalent, but they're getting way more, and autism is becoming more prevalent nowadays, but it's not getting as much spending. In fact, a few years ago, it only got $79 million for spending.
Wow.
And you're going to have a spending increasing throughout the next couple of years.
Yeah. these are real problems, real issues. It's a real diagnosis. It's a real thing. And the more we can learn about it, I think the better off we're all going to be. Dennis, thank you for telling your story today. I do want to just give the website for autismspeaks.org.
Please. Yeah.
That's it. It's autismspeaks.org. And they have a Michigan chapter, and they are doing some wonderful things. Let me see. I was looking for a phone number here as well. There is an opportunity to talk to someone in a sort of a counseling capacity. There are people that can help with potential for finding appropriate medical facilities for diagnosis, as well as community support. So here's the telephone number to Autism Speaks. It's 888-288-4762.
Or to translate that to the way it is usually read, it's 888-AUTISM-2.
Is it number 2?
Yes.
888-AUTISM and the number 2.
Yes.
There we go.
That's awesome. Thank you, Dennis. We appreciate so great having you back in our studios. Don't be a stranger, okay?
I was going to say, nice to have you here. I'm glad that we've had you back in our studios. It's the new WHFR Journal here at 89.3, also on the web at WHFR.FM. We've got more on the way. Please stay with us.
This is the new WHFR Journal. I'm Alan Mazurek, along with Susan McGraw. Thanks for being with us this Friday afternoon as we look at things going on in and around our community. And as we often do on this program, we're going to spend some time with a TED Talk that was given last year at TED Ann Arbor. And we've got a very special presentation which explores the topic of what's in a name here on what we well know by its name, the new WHFR Journal.
My name is Hoda Reza. I recognize that my name is not a familiar one to most people that I meet. I encounter names that are new to me as well. This is an occurrence that we should come to expect because names come from the immense number of ever-evolving languages in the world. Yet what we commonly do when we find ourselves in these new introductions is we continue on with the conversation and we likely will just avoid saying that person's name. Through this inaction, we have missed out on an invaluable opportunity to connect with others on a deeper level. I'm sure many of you have heard of the effective communication strategy to occasionally mention the other person's name while you speak to them. This leads to a more meaningful and personal dialogue because we generally enjoy hearing our names. And brain research supports this with evidence of a unique activation that occurs upon hearing our own names rather than the names of others. Now, because my name was mostly mispronounced throughout my life, I didn't always love hearing it. In fact, I hated my name. I didn't want to draw any more attention to it, so I would never correct anyone who mispronounced it, especially not my teachers. So in the second grade, I thought it was high time that I make the executive decision to change my name. So the brainstorming began as I pondered upon what normal name would be closest to Hoda. Hoda. Hoda might be closest to Heather. I then thought about my last name, Isa, which means Jesus in Arabic. And yes, everyone, Muslims do love Jesus. So I thought and thought, and then I've got it. The next day, with great pride and my head held high, I announced, "From now on, you can call me Heather Jesus." Not my most creative moment. So I laugh when I recall this memory, but I've also come to reflect upon why it was that I felt this need to change my identity. See, I was born and raised here in America. Clearly, this was not a high-profile photo shoot. I grew up in a neighborhood where my family was a minority as Muslims and as Arabs. So as you might imagine, there weren't too many other Hodas walking around. I was an avid reader as a child, and like most American children, I watched some TV and movies. All the while, subconsciously, I was absorbing the notions of what the normal names were, according to the names of the characters I most commonly encountered. And then there was the always hopeful, yet somewhat pitiable, search for Huda among the H section of name bracelets and souvenirs. Always a letdown. But I understand that those names that I saw were generally more common in those places. And those names continue to be the more common names, as countless bicultural families throughout our history and still today succumb to the pressure to abandon the names of their original languages and cultures in order to give themselves and or their children a name that they have come to understand will be deemed more acceptable in the society they live in. This pressure to conform began with the indigenous people of our land, who were literally forced to conform. And today, for many people, in their own ways, they still feel they are being forced to conform. And changing our names is just one example of this. Another illustration of this is that so many of us now feel very removed from that other world that we come from. No longer being able to speak another language that our ancestors may have spoken, or understanding the cultures of the people and places of our roots. I get the idea that we should all follow the same laws in order to live in civil and safe communities, but does that really mean that we all have to look the same and sound the same and think the same? We are members of the most powerful and influential species on Earth. And one of the factors that makes that so is our ability to communicate a great variety of thoughts and information. Here in America, this amazingly diverse place, filled with the power of possibilities that comes from learning from people with origins from nearly every region on Earth, we are in a prime position to take advantage of those benefits. Now, I myself am no stranger to those pressures to conform because I've wrestled with them most of my life. What I wasn't aware of is that while I was a victim to those limiting beliefs, I was a contributor as well. This epiphany occurred for me in my undergraduate studies here within the University of Michigan while taking a course called Multiculturalism in Education. It was only then that I realized that I was racist. I was prejudiced. Without a second thought, I openly made statements like, well, of course, all fill-in-the-blank people do that or are like that. This realization shook me to the core. How could I have those thoughts about others when these are ideas that I've been challenged with virtually as far back in my life as I could recall? I placed all of them in the same small box that others put me in, that same narrow box that I was always struggling to make my way out of. This humbling truth is not a lonely story. I did what many of us have done, and many of us still do, when we dismiss that all others are as distinctively individual as each of us truly are. I knew right then and there that if I gave in to the expected feelings of shame and regret, which no one enjoys, I would only continue to build a wall around the potential for what I could learn and what I could contribute to the world. Instead, I used this pivotal moment to clarify what the sources of those beliefs were and how it was that I couldn't show empathy when I had all of the material to do so right there before me in my own life experiences. I started where we all begin, childhood. What were the greatest influences in my life then? It was immediately clear that I couldn't blame my parents or my faith, which consistently taught me to show respect for all of creation. I then considered what other influences surrounded me, and this is when I began my learning of unconscious bias. You see, regardless of our backgrounds, from a very young age, We begin and continue to form unconscious biases based upon what we've been exposed to. And when it comes to various groups of people, we will find that what we've been exposed to is usually limited and often biased. Now, if I was unable to interact with a large number of people from these supposed backgrounds, what beliefs would I form about them based on the minimal representation I did see? And when it came to images of those who represented some of my own identities, they weren't always depicted in the most positive light either. This yielded not only biases for others, but inevitably, biases and a lowered self-esteem about my own identities. With this heightened awareness and continued reflection, I began taking down that wall brick by brick. And what I found before me was this uplifting, expanded view and a greater ability to reach out to my fellow brothers and sisters in humanity. This led to an undying enthusiasm to foster unity through knowledge. So I entered one of the most influential careers to allow me to do so when I became a teacher. On the first day of school, rather than just calling off names while I took attendance, I resolved to ask my students to teach me their names. Now, granted, this came with a little bit of resistance, with some students saying, "Oh no, Miss Issa, you just say it the way you want to." But I insisted that they teach me to say their names the way their parents say their names. This minimally altered beginning led to children having an increased confidence in their names and also having a more genuine interest in learning about the identities of others. Among many other remarkable side effects of this practice, one took me by surprise when one of my then third graders, who only spoke English, approached me and said, "Miss Issa, Khalud, Arturo, Hamza, and Ala are going to be in my group." And he said it just like that. He said, "Ha, Kha, A, Ra." And these are all sounds that are not in the English language. As adults, we know trying to pronounce sounds that are not in our native language isn't usually the easiest feat. But for children, it absolutely can be. Now, if this child ever decides to take on the wonderful endeavor of learning other languages, and those languages might use some similar sounds, he will now be better able to communicate fluently in that language, and therefore be better understood. There were so many teachable moments that came from this practice, and I really wanted to share them with as many others as I could. So when I couldn't find a children's book focused on this topic, I decided that I needed to write one myself. My book, Teach Us Your Name, is meant to empower children to teach others how to pronounce their names correctly, to embrace our awesome diversity, and to show more respect for their own identities and the identities of others. My hope is that we will soon swap out the lens in which we use to view names of applicants, candidates, students, so that we are just as comfortable in meeting Ayano, Bahati, and Fabienne as we are in meeting Anna, Bethany, and Frank. My passion for helping others tear down those walls that limit our potential continued as I went on to become a consultant in diversity, equity, and inclusion, where my slogan is, "Opening minds, connecting worlds." And we can begin doing so through this seemingly simple idea of the thing we all have in common around the world. We were all given a name. I'm going to use my own name to illustrate how we might go about doing this. My first name is Huda. Huda is pronounced like the hood of a car. Huda. Admittedly, I don't love comparing myself to a car part, but whatever works. Huda. Repeat after me. Huda. Huda. Oh, music to my ears. Huda is an Arabic word meaning positive guidance. My middle name is the name of my father, Allah Yirhama. And what I stated just now in Arabic is basically the equivalent of may God rest his soul. It is a common tradition for many Arabs to give all of their children the same middle name of their father's name. One of the reasons for doing this is that it allows for a more specific descriptor of who that individual is. So you're less likely to confuse me with one of my cousins or someone else who shares my last name. You'll also probably be quicker to figure out who siblings and parents are upon hearing their names. My father's name was Musa. Musa is Moses in Arabic. In fact, there are so many names that we hear that may sound foreign to many of us, but they're actually names of holy mention in the Abrahamic faiths. And if you recall, my last name, Isa, meaning Jesus, models this as well. I now love my name and all that it stands for. I am one who seeks and strives to deliver positive guidance. I'm an advocate for freedom and social justice like Moses was, and in doing so, I promote peace and understanding as the beloved Jesus did. Now, those are just some of the ways that my name benefits me, but how does it benefit others? Consider the knowledge you gained from learning my name. You learned how to pronounce and now know the meaning of an Arabic word, Huda. You learned that it is common practice for Arabs to have their father's names as their middle names. You learned that there is an Arabic blessing that is commonly stated when mentioning those who have passed away. You learned that names that sound familiar or sound foreign may actually be more familiar than we think. And you also learned that Muslims do love Jesus. Now imagine all of the conversations that could stem from those insights and the further knowledge to be gained. Even if you have an apparently common name, there is a story behind that name that represents your distinct place in our shared world. In your name, you will find history, languages, locations, customs, bloodlines, beliefs, and complexities that are as intricate as the tightly woven threads of the fabric that makes you, you. Our names serve as symbols of the evolution of who we are today, and we can use them as keys to open countless doors that may have otherwise remained closed. So let's use these keys that we all have to expand our minds and increase understanding so as to lay the foundation for increased unity. Because through unity comes strength. Around the globe, we exchange names in nearly every introduction to another fellow unique soul. Our names are where almost every relationship begins. So let's utilize that beginning to start a new norm, where rather than just telling us your names, you teach us your names.
Thank you. The TED Talk, What's in a Name?, given in Ann Arbor last year. This is the new WHFR Journal on the station Making Waves, 89.3, also on the web at WHFR.fm. Stay with us. We've got more to come here on the program. I'm Alan Mazurek. Welcome back. This is the new WHFR Journal here at 89.3. Also online at WHFR.fm. I'm Alan Mazurek along with Susan McGraw. We thank you so much for being with us this Friday afternoon. And as we often do, we welcome in Josh Hebert to have a little sports conversation here on our program as well. What a great discussion we had last week with Gwen Burton, the incoming, well, I mean the current women's basketball coach, and also with athletic director Rochelle Taylor.
Yeah, it was very insightful for me being the sports editor at the paper here, being on air with you guys a lot recently, and hopefully was great for our listeners to hear what's going on here at Henry Ford.
Well, we look forward to enjoying you continuing your award-winning reporting, both on the air here at WHFR and for the Mirror News, our campus newspaper.
So, thank you.
What's been going on in the world of sports? And I know sometimes, especially with some of the crazy weather we've had, there's been a lot of postponements.
Mints.
It's hard to keep track of when games are being played. What's been going on? I know the baseball team had some games yesterday. They are going to be on the road
today.
The women's softball team's going to be in town, right?
Yeah, they are home today at Heritage Park, 3 and 5 o'clock against Macomb Community College.
All right, so doubleheader.
Three and 5 o'clock,
and they often do that. They play a couple of games, and then probably some other time in the season, our team goes there and plays a couple of games. So,
well, other way around, and.
Indeed. Well, speaking of softball, and this is worth mentioning because it doesn't happen very often, even at the high school level. And I know that you have some history down there in Allen Park.
Yes, I do. Graduate, helped coach there for a few years for the baseball side of things.
For the softball team, Sydney Uhlenberg threw a perfect game.
That's amazing. And against a rival in Wyandotte.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, give it up to her. Also on that team is sister of current Hawks player, Kaylee Littleton, Kelsey, who hit a 3-1 home run to help break that game open a little bit. And also, congrats to Patsy Cornell, the coach there for the softball team. She's been there longer than I've been in school.
Oh, and obviously, putting together a great program there.
She has.
And obviously, some of the girls that have come through that program. You mentioned her sister, who plays for the Hawks right now.
Kaylee.
Kaylee, who's having a good season, I guess, as well, right?
She is hitting about .500 on the season so far in about 28 games.
Well, that's
phenomenal.
So how much is left to the season? I know that, in terms of school-wise, we got final exams next week.
There's about 4 more games left in the regular season for the softball team and about a handful left for the baseball team, who actually got to play out at Willie Horton Field last weekend.
Oh, with the old Tiger Stadium was right there at Michigan and Trumbull. What a thrill! And I know that there a lot of people have a lot of opinions about the redevelopment of that place and what the field is. But really, if you've grown up in this area and played baseball, being able to play at Michigan and Trumbull is pretty cool, right?
Yeah, looks phenomenal. The field does. The Hawks did split the series that they played there, so congrats to them as well.
Excellent. Josh, thanks so much. Have a great weekend. We look forward to seeing you again, and maybe we'll have a season wrap-up coming up here sometime soon. And
hopefully.
Keep up the great work.
Yeah, thank you. You too.
This is the new WHFR Journal. I'm Alan Mazurek. Thanks so much for being with us this Friday afternoon. We've got all sorts of great stuff coming up. A wonderful Friday of programming here on WHFR, so you can leave the radio right where it's at. And certainly for the next couple of hours, you're going to take a trip down Highway 61 with Kitty Love when we come back with some music programming here on the station Making Waves. Have a great weekend.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio featuring local and independent artists. Time.
where my baby stayed. Yes, I traveled all the time. That's where my baby stayed. When I leave the big cities, where I make my getaway. When I get down to Clarksdale, south of Memphis, Tennessee. When I get down to Clarksdale, south of Memphis, Tennessee.
This is the magic of radio, and you are listening to WHFR Dearborn.
And welcome to Highway 61. I hope you're having a good afternoon. I'm DJ Kitty Love, and I will be with you for the next 2 hours. Going to bring you the best of blues, new blues releases, and Detroit blues. And tell you about some wonderful jazz going on in the city tonight. Want to tell you that you were listening to the theme song for Highway 61, the long-running blues program here on Henry Ford College Radio, WHFR.FM 89.3. That was Eddie Shaw, the late Eddie Shaw, from the CD called In the Land of the Crossroads. That is a song called Delta Bound on the Rooster Blues Records label. And I'm bringing you some new blues from Little Boys Blue with Kid Memphis. The new one is called Hard Blue Space. And we're going to start out the show with this brand new CD from Little Boys Blue with a song called